The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Volume 4, The Medieval World. Episode 74, The Travels of Marco Polo. Today's story starts in Venice, the city of islands in a lagoon in northeast Italy, which faces the Adriatic Sea, famous for its maze of canals and seemingly endless amount of bridges. In the modern day, it is an Italian city. But during the medieval period, it was its own republic, built on maritime trade. After the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, peoples of the Adriatic coast who spoke a Latin language called Venetian found that their lands were the subject of southward migrations from Germanic peoples such as the Ostrogoths and the Lombards. The Venetian speakers fled to the relative safety of the islands in the lagoon, and so the beginnings of what would develop into the modern city of Venice were realised. Venice managed to maintain its Latin identity during the chaos that befell the Italian peninsula in the aftermath of the fall of Western Rome. Venice's isolation from the mainland enabled it to develop in relative independence. Some of the families on the islands would develop a good amount of wealth, and this would lead to the city establishing a bishopric and a dukedom. The wealth was generated by naval trade, and this was facilitated to some degree by the Eastern Roman Empire, also called the Byzantine Empire, which protected Venice, helped by their common ancestral links to Latin culture. Under this protected status, the Venetians became more wealthy and more powerful, extending their trade links to the Eastern Mediterranean, including the Byzantine Empire, and Egypt. Venice attempted to maintain an independence from the affairs which pitted the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire against each other. But in the ever-changing world of maritime trade routes of the Mediterranean Sea, Venice would have to learn how to defend itself and its interests. Up until the 12th century, the relationship between Venice and the Byzantines had been beneficial for both sides. Venice prospered thanks to the support of the Byzantines, and the Byzantines would have a powerful trade mediator and naval ally in the west. When the Byzantines started working alongside maritime trade rivals of Venice, such as Genoa, the Venetians really went into business for themselves, battling to take complete control of the maritime trading posts within the Byzantine Empire. So, tensions grew. During this period, the power of Venice had enabled them to create a realm which contained areas of land on the mainland, and a great council was formed which would rule Venice as a republic. The Venetians considered themselves every bit as influential as the Byzantines, regardless of any relations garnered between the Byzantine Empire and trade rivals such as Genoa. Pope Innocent III called a crusade against the Ayyubid Sultanate at the beginning of the 13th century in order to regain control of Jerusalem for the Christians. The Venetians became actively involved in the transport of crusaders. But when the crusaders failed to pay the Venetians, the Venetians took the opportunity to turn the crusade into a Latin conquest of Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire. This was a considerably prosperous time for Venice, and this brings us into the period of this week's episode. Two Venetian brothers, who were merchants, were enjoying the prosperity that Venice was now enjoying as a major player in Mediterranean trade, and their names were Niccolò and Maffeo Polo. Niccolò and Maffeo headed out of Venice to see if they could generate some wealth in the Latin Empire capital city of Constantinople. However, Constantinople was traditionally the capital of the Byzantine Empire, and although the Latins had run the Byzantines out of Constantinople, the Byzantines had ambitions of reclaiming their lost empire. Niccolò and Maffeo recognised the dangers of the political situation and decided to move over the Black Sea to Crimea, which was likely occupied by Turkic peoples, who were under the influence of the Golden Horde, the westernmost Mongol Empire polity. When the Byzantines did successfully reclaim Constantinople, the fate of many Venetians there was quite grim. So the two brothers were well out of it. With very little chance of being able to return to Venice, the merchant brothers ended up on a journey eastwards, really through no fault of their own, and because political circumstances dictated it. Tensions were mounting between the Golden Horde and the Ilkhanate, which was also a polity of the Mongol Empire. So the brothers decided to keep on the move. While in the modern Uzbekistani city of Bukhara, the two brothers would meet a messenger of the Mongols, who invited them to travel to China. The two brothers arrived in China and were introduced to the Chinese ruler, himself a member of the Mongol ruling family and named Kublai Khan. Kublai Khan would be enthusiastic about meeting these European merchants, and saw an opportunity to make connections with the West and the Christian Church. Kublai Khan would send Niccolò and Maffeo Polo back to Europe to deliver a message to the Pope in an attempt to establish a cultural connection between Mongol China and Christian Europe. So the two brothers did indeed return to Europe after over 10 years of absence. Before the two brothers had left Venice during the 1250s, Niccolò had left behind an infant son called Marco. Now it was the beginning of the 1270s, and Marco was fast becoming a young man when he would see his father again, when Niccolò had returned from China. Marco's mother had recently passed away, so the decision was made to take young Marco with them on the challenging journey all the way back to the Far East and the court of Kublai Khan.
Marco's journey to China.
Kublai Khan had set Niccolò and Maffeo the task of taking a message to the Pope, who at the time was Pope Clement IV. By the time the two brothers had made it back to Venice, Pope Clement had died. so the two brothers decided to wait for the election of the new pope before setting off for the Far East once again. It just so happened that the election of a new pope on this occasion was taking longer than it has ever taken in the history of the Catholic Church. The lack of cohesiveness between the senior cardinals of the Catholic Church prevented an effective election from taking place. The two brothers were not prepared to wait forever for the church to sort itself out, so they decided to set off on a galley across the Mediterranean Sea to the Levant. They landed at the city of Acre, which is in the modern country of Israel, and at the time was within the Crusader state called the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Kublai Khan had requested from the Pope that he be supplied with 100 educated priests and some oil from the lamp at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The two brothers were given permission to go to Jerusalem and obtain the oil, but without a Pope, it was impossible to take 100 priests. The two brothers then sailed to a location called Lias, which has been identified as the coastal settlement called Ayash, which is in the modern Mersin province of Turkey, which was an area under the control of the Mongol Ilkhanate. It was while the Polos were in Ayash that they learned that a man called Teobaldo Visconti had been elected as the new pope, and to be known as Pope Gregory X. And rather than send 100 priests to accompany the Polos to China, the new pope would send two friars. But these two friars dipped out of the mission very quickly, choosing not to complete the journey. Thanks to the extensive conquests of the Mongols earlier in the century, a period which has been referred to as Pax Mongolica existed, referring to the fact that merchants could travel in relative safety from west to east due to the fact that the Mongols controlled all of the lands of the Silk Road. The period has also been dubbed as the Pax Tartarica, and this is in direct reference to the Tartars. We know that the Mongols subjugated the Tartars very early in Mongol expansions, but from the Western context, many of the peoples under the rule of the Mongols were of Turkic origin, and so a familiar term used to refer to those Turkic people under Mongol rule was Tartars. So, for example, when the Mongol Golden Horde invaded Poland and Hungary, it is not unusual to see the European nations refer to this as a Tartar invasion. Thanks to this Pax Mongolica, the Polos were able to travel across Persia. Marco would recall seeing a great number of exotic goods passing through this central hub of the Silk Road. Porcelain from China, spices from India, incense from the Arabian Peninsula, and worked metal from the Levant, just to reference a few. In order to travel from Persia to the Silk Roads in the north, the party would need to tackle the mountain ranges of Central Asia, including the Hindu Kush and the Pamir Mountains. The mountains were quite inhospitable, with extreme temperatures during day and night. The mountain passes were very remote and unprotected. After managing to cross the extreme mountain ranges, the journey would not become any easier, with vast deserts needing to be crossed. Some of the cities encountered were just left in ruins following the Mongol conquests just a few decades earlier. It is said that it took the Polos 30 days to cross the Gobi Desert, but once they had near enough reached China after four long, hard years of travel.
At the court of Kublai Khan.
When Kublai Khan learned of the arrival of his two friends, Niccolo and Maffeo Polo, he was thrilled and afforded them great levels of hospitality. Kublai Khan admired their loyalty and accepted their gifts. Kublai Khan then asked about the young man who was accompanying them, and so Niccolo introduced him to his son, Marco. Kublai Khan welcomed Marco with the same warmth and hospitality, and so a great relationship between Kublai and Marco began to develop. Marco would be allowed to work on behalf of the Great Khan, and in return, Marco would be able to promote the Great Khan and open diplomatic opportunities on the Great Khan's behalf. Marco was clearly an exceptional young man, and Kublai Khan apparently recognised this. With the opportunities that Kublai Khan was willing to give him, Marco made it his business to learn as much about the languages and customs of the peoples that he would be visiting and liaising with as possible, in order to ingratiate himself with them. Marco was sent southwards by the Great Khan towards the lands of mainland Southeast Asia, and particularly what we know today as the Yunnan province of China, where the Upper Yangtze River can be located. Marco would then gather knowledge and information which he would later record, as we will find out later in the episode. While in the south, Marco would visit a province called Karazan. Marco would give us a very vivid description of a type of serpent that he saw in this area. He described it as being over 9 meters long and almost 2.5 meters in girth. The serpents were said to have a large mouth with immense teeth, said to be capable of swallowing a man whole. The locals would set traps for these serpents, which would spike them. The meat would be regarded as a delicacy, but the gallbladder was considered to have great medicinal value, able to ease the labour pains of women and cure the bite of a mad dog. What these serpents really are is difficult to say, but it would be one element of Marco's stories which would gather intrigue by those who read it. Some would believe all of these things to be true, while others would dismiss it as pure fantasy. Logically, what actually could this creature be? Well, many believe that due to the area of the world that Marco was in, and due to the description of the animal, that he is likely referring to the crocodile, an animal unknown to Europeans. To the average European, who would have had no experience of such animals, it must have seemed like Marco was describing a mythological Chinese dragon. In our episode about the Song Dynasty of China, which took us back in time to the period around the 11th century, we spoke about how the Chinese had started producing printed paper promissory notes, which were used in place of metal coinage. So we can describe these as the earliest known banknotes or paper currency. Marco was quite astonished by the fact that Kublai Khan was allowing these promissory notes to be used as currency, with the piece of paper having no value. But essentially it was a promise from Kublai Khan himself to pay the holder themselves. So Kublai Khan was actually the central bank in this case. It is likely that Marco Polo's knowledge of the paper note system had some influence on the eventual emergence of paper currency in Europe. Another observation that Marco made was in regards to the communication systems within Yuan, China, the name for the Mongol ruling dynasty. The value of efficient land routes is something that we take for granted in the modern world with our railway lines and tarmacked roads. Before the modern world, sea travel was the fastest way to travel long distances, and land travel was a challenge. The Persians and the Romans were noted for their innovations when it came to developing land routes. The Mongols in China had developed a very impressive system of their own, undoubtedly based on previous systems that had already existed. Not only were the Mongols highly efficient at conveying messages and instructions on the battlefield by using a system of flags, but they were also highly efficient when it came to relaying messages throughout China in general. And this is because they had developed a system of relaying messages from station to station until it reached its destination. So it has been referred to as a type of postal service. Men would run on foot from station to station, with a typical distance between such stations being 3 miles. When the man would reach the station, another man would be waiting to run the next leg of the journey. For longer distances, horses were used, and the stations would have the appropriate facilities for both horses and messengers to remain fed and watered. Although Europeans did have a similar system for relaying messages, Marco Polo noted that it was not nearly as efficient as the system used by the Mongols. Knowledge is also something that we take for granted in the modern world, where we have the internet at our fingertips. In some areas of Europe, coal was being burned for heat, but not in Venice. In Venice, they used wood. So when Marco Polo discovered coal being burned in China, he felt compelled to mention it in his writings. For Marco, he had simply witnessed stones that burn like logs. Marco's travels around the Far East would take him as far south as the Burmese kingdom of Pagan. But as much as Marco was probably living a privileged life at the court of Kublai Khan, a trusted foreigner in the land of Chinese subjects, there was a desire from Marco to return to Venice. Each time this view was expressed, Kublai Khan denied Marco the ability to return, and Marco would know that attempting to return west without the approval of the Great Khan was a virtual impossibility. All in all, Marco was working at the service of Kublai Khan for around 17 years.
The Journey West.
Buluan was a Mongol princess who was married to the Ilkhan Abaka Khan. Abaka's father was Hulagu Khan, the ruler of the Ilkhanate, and Hulagu was Kublai Khan's brother. Strictly speaking, the Ilkhanate, although autonomous, was under the rule of the Great Khan, Kublai Khan, which is why it is called the Ilkhanate, with the term Ilkhan meaning subordinate Khan. Buluan was the principal wife of Abaka Khan. As we are already aware, Mongol rulers were expected to have numerous wives and concubines. When Abaka Khan died, the rule of the Ilkhanate passed briefly to his brother Tekuda, and then to Abaka's son Argun. Argun would add his father's wife Buluan to his own list of wives, and this is likely to be because the highly regarded Buluan would have been entitled to the benefits and protection that being the current Khan's wife would bring. Buluan would actually be Argun's 9th wife. Buluan died in the year 1286, and Argun would reach out to Kublai Khan to send him a new wife from Buluan's family clan. A teenage girl called Kokhchin was chosen. The Polo family had appealed to Kublai Khan on a number of occasions to allow them to return home to Venice, and it was continually refused. Kublai Khan would then go on to entrust the Polos to escort the young Princess Kokhchin to the Ilkhanate in order to marry Argun Khan. After carrying out this incredibly important responsibility, the Polos would be allowed to return home to Venice at long last. They had enjoyed the hospitality and the gifts of Kublai Khan, but now Kublai Khan was an elderly man in his 70s, and without Kublai Khan, who knows what the fate of the Polos and all of their possessions would have been. So Kublai Khan may have allowed them to leave out of respect for the Polos and that potential outcome. Kublai Khan gave the Polos a gold tablet called a paitsu, which acted like a kind of passport from the Great Khan himself, which afforded the Polos special privileges and safe passage on their journey. They set out from the port of Quanzhou, which sits on the Taiwan Strait, the channel that separates the East China Sea from the South China Sea. A fleet of 14 large junks were manned by at least 600 people. When setting sail, the Polos would be utilising thriving maritime trade routes that were bringing such things to China as spices from India. However, the fleet suffered misfortune early in their long voyage, experiencing bad weather which severely hampered their progress. Many men were lost, but it is not clear how. We do know that some eventually reached the island of Sumatra, and that they would have to wait for some time for the winds to switch direction so that they could continue westwards. While forced to camp in Sumatra, Marco Polo reported enjoying good quality fish, wine and nuts, but also that they were in the company of ritual cannibals who may have been an Austronesian peoples called the Bataks. Also, Marco Polo claimed that there were unicorns the size of elephants and men with tails. The large unicorns are suggested to have actually been rhinoceroses. But the men with tails are not something that I can explain. Eventually, when they were allowed to leave Sumatra, the fleet set sail for India. In India, Marco Polo experienced the trade of many spices and precious gems. The journey from Sumatra to India was highly challenging, with arduous weather conditions and the threat of pirates. Another observation made by Marco Polo was the cultural act of bride burning, which relates to the acts of dowry payments that the bride's family are expected to make to the groom. Essentially, it involves the murder of the bride by burning as a punishment for the failure to honour the dowry. And I'm sorry to tell you that the heinous act of bride burning is still a problem which exists in this area of the world today. The final stop for the fleet was at Hormuz, which was a Persian port controlled by the Ilkhanate, the very polity that the Mongol princess Cochin was intended for. Much of the fleet did not complete the journey, and it's possible that some of the men chose not to continue rather than become the victim of bad weather or piracy. It was around the time of their arrival in the Ilkhanate that the Polos learned of the death of Kublai Khan. And although the Polos were travelling under the protection of Kublai Khan, the Paitsu that they possessed were still honoured. And the Polos enjoyed the hospitality of those who they came into contact with that were loyal to the Mongols. The Ilkhan, who was intended for the Princess Cochin, was Argun Khan. But by the time Cochin had arrived in the Ilkhanate, Argun Khan had died, and so Cochin married his son Mahmud Ghazan, who would later become Ghazan Khan. Princess Cochin was said to have been heartbroken to have parted company with the Polos, with whom she had been through so much with. The party continued across land to reach the Black Sea, and then a sea journey back to Venice. Even this leg of the journey appeared to take a lot of time, as the Polos did not arrive back in Venice until 1295, which is 4 years after they left China. When they first arrived back, the Venetians were quite wary of these orientalised travellers who had been away for 24 years and had been somewhat forgotten about. Within the seams of their strange clothes were a wealth of precious jewels and other valuable objects, which the Venetians would celebrate after their initial scepticism. The Venetians were very keen to bring wealth into their domain, as the Genoese were now in a bitter war with them, being their main Mediterranean trade rivals.
Il Milione.
The ongoing war between the Venetians and the Genoese required Marco to command a galley, but unfortunately he was captured by the Genoese and imprisoned. The Genoese had also had problems which led to conflict with the Republic of Pisa, and one Pisan that had already been imprisoned was Rustichello. Rustichello was a romance writer, and while Rustichello and Marco Polo were imprisoned together, Rustichello would record in writing the stories of Marco Polo's journey to and from China, and what he did and what he saw while he was there. Due to Rustichello being an author by vocation, his work was written in Franco-Italian, which is believed to have simply been a literary language as opposed to a spoken language. Marco Polo and Rustichello were both eventually released from prison, and it didn't take long for Rustichello's writings to be published. In the English-speaking world, the works are called The Travels of Marco Polo, but it has had various names, including a curious name, Il Milione. In Italian, this translates to The Million. It is believed that Il Milione was a nickname for Marco Polo himself, but why would Marco Polo have a vast number as this seemingly glorious nickname? It has been suggested that it is because Marco was a subject of Kublai Khan that Kublai Khan's wealth could be counted in the millions. However, it appears that Marco Polo's father also had the nickname Il Milione, and that it could simply be a means by which to distinguish their family line from other members of Polo family branches. Either way, it is not clear. The book itself was very popular and highly sought after. Significantly, it was translated into Latin, among other languages, very quickly, and its popularity is very significant in an age before the printing press had enabled the works of European writers to be distributed on a large scale. However, some critics have suggested that some of the content of the book has been fabricated, and these aspects have been discussed ever since. Some have even suggested that the nickname Il Milione is based on the fact that Marco told a million lies. It is one thing to suggest that the story of Marco Polo's accounts are a pack of lies if you're living in Venice in the early 14th century and you have never had experience of anything in your life outside of Venice or other than what you have been told. But it's another thing to say that in more modern times with modern information at your disposal. The book tells us of birds that can carry and consume elephants, and that they are native to the island of Madagascar. We know that there were large birds native to Madagascar that are now extinct called elephant birds. But not only are they believed to have gone extinct before Marco Polo's lifetime, but also we have no reason to believe that Marco Polo ever went anywhere near Madagascar during his travels. The notion of a mythological raptor that could gather an elephant in its talons exists in medieval Arabic literatures, and Marco Polo could have just simply been repeating things that he had been told. The discussion will be ongoing due to there being many factors that can be scrutinised. It is interesting to note that there are no records of Marco Polo in contemporary Chinese texts, and the other emissaries are certainly mentioned. The counter-argument is that Kublai Khan had so many emissaries that Marco Polo was not special in any way by comparison to others from the Eastern perspective. It is also probable that Mongol documents were destroyed after their tenure as the rulers of China was over. The mention of things such as paper money and porcelain was not revolutionary to European merchants who were already aware of such things before Marco Polo wrote about them. For all of those things that critics question, such as obvious omissions, like there being no mention of the Great Wall of China and the mass consumption of tea, there are those things that critics say could not have been detailed so vividly had Marco not experienced these things firsthand. After his imprisonment, Marco Polo had a family. He married a Venetian noblewoman called Donata Badoer, and they would have three daughters, one of which is known for having to fight against her husband's family to prevent them from claiming her inherited wealth. We know very little about Marco's later life, but we do know that he passed away at the age of 69 in the year 1324. Even if we suppose in any way that the works of Marco Polo were untrue to any lesser or greater degree, we cannot deny the impact that these works would have. Not only do we have a contemporary historical reference about life in the 13th century in various different cultures around the world, but we also have a book which contemporaries and future generations would be excited about. Travellers would be intrigued and tempted to go on journeys of discovery themselves, believing that it was indeed possible. Cartographers would be able to construct better maps to be able to facilitate the journeys of future explorers based on the content of Marco Polo's work. Likewise, European merchants would have a better understanding of the opportunities open to them should they have the nerve to travel eastwards. The rewards could now be understood, so many more merchants would consider it worth the risk. So the work was inspirational, and there's possibly no greater endorsement than the claim that just two centuries after the work was penned, the very famous Genoese explorer, Christopher Columbus, carried a copy of this work as he set sail westwards in search of an alternative route to the lands of China that he had read about. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast on the travels of Marco Polo. Now, if you enjoy listening to this podcast and you'd like to support the podcast, do your best to support the podcast, then visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. You can sign up for as little as $1 a month. You'll become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you'll qualify for gifts and rewards. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, please drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And you can also follow the podcast on our social media pages, Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Tumblr, Threads, and Mastodon. And if you can't get enough of the podcast, then look out for the special debrief episode where I'll be talking some more about the episode that you just listened to and a few extra bits and pieces. Now, if you enjoy listening to the listener messages and reviews, just go back to the previous episode, the History of the World podcast magazine, and you can catch up with them all there. But that's it for this particular episode. Next time on the next full episode, episode number 75, we'll be talking about the Ming Dynasty of China, which we hear a lot when talking about Ming vases, for example. So it's we're looking at that period of Chinese history, and that's going to be sort of the pretty much the end of medieval China. We're going to talk a bit about gunpowder before moving on to another part of the world. So if you want to listen to some more, you want to listen to a little bit more rambling about the episode that you just listened to, then please do switch over to our publication on the debrief of the travels of Marco Polo. Just look that up in your History of the World podcast listing. It should be there. It should be there very shortly, if it isn't there already. But until next time, thanks very much for listening, and be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.